In the Toils. How narrow is the span when we look back upon our own lives! How vast when we contemplate the world's abysmal past! And yet we lose ourselves as easily, as dreamily in the one as in the other, by virtue of our perception of a unity between the two. As little in the small sphere as in the large can we go back to the time of our birth and the beginning of our days, to say nothing of further back. It lies in darkness before the beginnings of the dawn of consciousness or memory. But with our earliest mental life, when we first enter, as primitive man once entered, into civilization, giving and receiving our first little contributions, we are aware of a sympathy. We feel ourselves recognize that abiding unity. With pleased surprise, we acclaim our kinship with the larger whole. And the content of the kinship is always the same. It is the idea of a catastrophe, the invasion of destructive and wanton forces into an ordered scheme, and a life bent upon self-control and a happiness conditioned by it. The saga of peace wrung from conflict and seemingly assured, of life laughingly sweeping away the structure of art, of mastery and overpowering and the coming of the stranger god, all that was there from the beginning, as it was in the middle. And in a late age which is aware of its affinity with human beings, we find ourselves still united with them in that bond of sympathy. For Mut M. Enet, Potiphar's wife, the sweet singer, that faraway form which the epic spirit grants us to see as though close at hand, she too was one afflicted and overpowered, a bacchantic sacrifice to the stranger god, the careful structure of her life no less than wrecked by the nether powers which, in her ignorance, she had thought to mock, whereas they alone it was who made mock of all her compensations and supercompensations. Old Huia might well have told her not to be a goose, not a bird of the black, waterlogged depths whom the swan visiteth and covereth, not a goose, but a moon-chaste priestess, yet not the less feminine for that. He himself, old Huia, had dwelt in the marshy, murky, brother-sister darkness, yet felt strange and awkward stirrings of conscience and intuitions that new things were come to pass in the world. He had mutilated his little son to be a courtier of light, sapped his son's virile powers, and made him a human nonentity, and then given him in the stern bond of marriage to the woman who bore the ancient name of Mother. Now might they see themselves prop up each other's dignity by dint of tact and mutual consideration. It is undeniable that human dignity realizes itself in the two sexes, male and female, so that when one is neither one nor the other, one stands outside the human pale. And whence, then, can human dignity come? Efforts to sustain it are worthy of respect, for they deal with the spiritual, and thus, let us admit in honor, with the preeminently human. But truth demands the hard confession that thought and the spirit come badly off in the long run against nature. How little can the precepts of civilization avail against the dark, deep, silent knowledge of the flesh? How little it lets itself be taken in by the spirit? All this we saw in the early days of our story in connection with the bewilderment of Rachel. And now Rachel's sister here below, Mut, once princess of the gnome, by virtue of her relation with the Sun Chamberlain, was just as remote from the female side of human life as he was from the male. As a woman, she led a life as hollow, as dishonoring to the flesh, as did he. Nor were her compensations, and the Amun honor in which she thought to veil her dim perceptions from herself, any less frail a support, though a support to the spirit, than those props to the amour propre of her fat husband when he posed as a horse-tamer and hippopotamus-hunter and urged himself on to feats of valor. Joseph had known how to flatter his master by making these exploits appear as the essence of masculinity, but actually they were sicklied and forced, and when Petipre went hunting in the swamps, he was always yearning for the peace and quiet of his library. In other words, for the life of the mind, pure and simple and quite unapplied. However, we are not now thinking of Petipre, but of his Eni, the priestess of Amun, and of the anguishing dilemma of her position between the honor of the spirit and the honor of the flesh. Two dark eyes had done this to her, the eyes of a beloved one who had lived far away and been all too extravagantly loved. Her surrender to them was by its nature nothing else than a violent, terrified outburst concerned to save, in the last or almost the last moment, her fleshly honor and her human womanhood. To save, or rather to secure it, though it meant the abandonment and sacrifice of her spiritual and religious honor, of everything in the realm of the idea on which her life was based. Let us pause here to look at her situation. Look at it with the eyes of this woman who thought of nothing else by day and night in a torture of mounting desire. Was it a genuine dilemma? Does that sacrifice always and everywhere dishonor and desecrate? That was the question. Does dedication amount to chastity? Yes and no. For her state of bridehood involved certain contradictions which cancelled each other out. The veil, the token of the goddess of love, is also the token of its sacrifice, the sign at once of the nun and of the courtesan. The spirit of her time and her temple recognized the consecrated and immaculate. The Kadesha, who was an enticer, that is to say, a street prostitute. Theirs was the veil. These Kadishtu were immaculate, as is an animal, which, precisely because of its immaculateness, is destined for a sacrifice to God in the feast. Consecrated? One asks, to whom? And why? If one is consecrated to Ishtar, then chastity is only a phase of the sacrifice, a veil destined to be rent. Such were Moot's lovelorn thoughts as she wrestled, and if the little dwarf had heard them, he would, in his fear of sex, his remoteness from all such ideas, have wept at the insidiousness of her thoughts, so little serviceable to reason, so prone to go on all fours. It would have been easy for him to weep, knowing as he did nothing of human dignity, being but a little dancing dervish of a man, but to Moot, the mistress, it was a matter of the honor of her flesh, and she sought out thoughts by which she might reconcile it with her religious honor. So we owe her consideration and sympathy, however much she rationalized, for thoughts are seldom present for their own sake only. She had hard work with hers, for her awakening to her womanhood from that sleep of the senses in which she had rested as aristocrat, lady, and priestess was nothing like the traditional one of the daughter of the king summoned by the sight of the majesty of the Prince of Heaven from the peace of childhood to endure the torment and desire of consuming love. She had not the fatal happiness of loving so exaltedly above her station, which condemns one in the end to accept the extremest pangs of jealousy and even to be turned into a cow. No, her misfortune lay, in her mind, in the fact that she loved so far below it. A nameless slave, a bought chattel and Asiatic house servant. That was bitterer to her dainty pride than anything we have had so far to tell. It long prevented her from admitting her feelings even to herself, and when she finally did so, there mingled, in the bliss which love always brings us, an element of humiliation which, rising from the deepest depths of cruelty, can arm desire with its sharpest thorn. The rationalization which she sought to apply to these humbling thoughts centered in the fact that the Kadesha and temple maiden cannot seek out her own lover either, her caresses being the property of him who throws the price in her lap. But how unavailing the justification! What violence it did to herself in allotting her so passive a role! For surely hers was the active, wooing, choosing part. Though even so, she had not been quite independent, her choice having been guided by Dudu's complaints. But her station and years entitled her to the position of attack and challenge. It could never have been possible that the slave of his own motion and will had lifted up his eyes to her, or that she could have been the submissive recipient of his desire. Never. In this affair, her pride decisively laid claim to the masculine role. And yet, in the depths of her being, the role did not suit. For however one might try to twist the fact, it remained true that this young servant, consciously and willfully or not, had been, by virtue of his existence, the awakener of her womanhood from its enchanted sleep. and had therewith made himself the master of his mistress, so that she served him in her thoughts, and hung upon his eyes, in panic lest he see that she would be his, yet trembling for fear lest he might requite her incommunicable longings. All in all, it was a humility pervaded by a frightful sweetness. Yet she sought to lessen it, as passion will do. For while not at all actuated by considerations of worth or dignity, it will always seek to seem so, and to justify itself in all possible ways for its choice. Thus she contrived to raise the boy whose mistress she would be out of his lowly condition, adducing his bearing, his cleverness, his position in the house. She even, taking a leaf from Dudu's book, called in religion to justify her proneness to all fours, as the mock vizier would have said. In other words, she brought into the field Atum Re of On, the complacent god, friendly to foreigners, against stern old Amun, her former lord, and enlisted the court, the royal power itself, in support of her love, which, for her subtilizing conscience, had the further advantage that she came closer in spirit to her husband, Pharaoh's friend, and won him, in a certain sense, as a party to her own burning wish to betray him. Thus Mut M. Enet, twisting and turning in the toils of her own desire, as in the coils of a serpent sent by a god to embrace and strangle her, so that she gasped for breath. And she wrestled alone. She had no one to talk to save Dudu, with whom she never got beyond veiled allusion, at least not in the beginning, for later she lost all restraint and made her whole entourage partakers of her frenzy. Remember further that the urge of her blood had lighted upon a zealot, one devoted to higher purposes, wearing the rue in token of his loyalty and proud devotion. In other words, one set apart, who might not and would not yield to her allure. Remember finally that her torture lasted 3 years, from the 7th to the 10th of Joseph's sojourn in Potiphar's house, and then was not satisfied, but only slain. And remembering all this, shall we not concede that the lot of Potiphar's wife, lewd wanton as she was in the popular legend, was a tragic one? Shall we not bestow upon her at least the pity born of the perception that the instruments of such a trial bear their punishment in themselves, and have it in fuller measure than they deserve, considering the inevitability of their function.